Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/acast. That's burrow.com/acast. burrow.com/acast.
Hello and welcome to Curious Canadian History. I'm your host, David Boris. As many Canadians are probably aware, in September of 2023, the Canadian Parliament gave a standing ovation to 98-year-old Jaroslav Hunka, who at the time was celebrated because of his role in fighting the Soviets during the Second World War. This incident soon became a national and international embarrassment when it was realized that while Hunka did indeed fight the Soviets, he did so as part of an SS regiment. He fought for the Nazis. In the aftermath of this scandal, it came to light that Canada, in fact, welcomed various members of the Ukrainian community into Canada after the war, some of whom had indeed fought with the Nazis, many of whom were SS. How did Hunka end up receiving a standing ovation in Canada's parliament? How did nobody seem to know he had fought for the Nazis? And more importantly, why did Canada open its borders to SS veterans in the post-war period? These questions make up the core of an incredible discussion I had with historian and author Per Anders Rudlin. Per and myself both were doing our graduate studies at the University of Alberta back in 2005-2006, when Per was actively working on the subject of SS veterans in Canada, many of whom had settled in Alberta and even became prominent donors to the University of Alberta. In this part one of a two-episode special, Per takes us through the history of the 1st Ukrainian Division, also known as the 14th Waffen-SS Division Galician. And Per talks about how and why SS veterans were allowed into Canada after the war and how they became leading members of the Canadian-Ukrainian community, and thus had a direct role in shaping what we remembered and what we swept under the rug when it came to their role in fighting for the Nazis. This is Season 9, Episode 4, The SS in Canada, Part 1. Per Anders Rudlin is a historian at Lund University in Sweden, and he focuses on the subjects of nationalism, historical culture, and historical memory in the regions that today make up parts of Ukraine, Belarus, and Lithuania. His 2015 book, The Rise and Fall of Belarusian Nationalism, won the Kolchicki Book Prize, and he is currently researching Ukrainian nationalism during the Cold War. I began our conversation by asking Per to give us some historical background to the 14th Waffen-SS Division Galician.
Well, the units we are talking about is the 14th Waffen-SS Division Galician, or Halychin 9 Ukrainian, or the 1st Ukrainian Division. That is a military formation which was set up in the spring of 1943, a Waffen-SS formation consisting of Galician Ukrainians from Western Ukraine that volunteered for the Waffen-SS and took a personal oath to Adolf Hitler. As the Third Reich was crumbling and the Eastern Front was crumbling, the German overlords needed all the manpower they could get. So they started expanding the Waffen-SS with a number of non-German formations. They got a Latvian one, an Estonian one, a Croat one, Albanian one, and Cossack one, and so on. And one of these many Waffen-SS formations was this Galician Ukrainian Waffen-SS unit. It was consisting of volunteers. About 80,000 Galician Ukrainians volunteered for the unit, of which about 9,000 were actually accepted. The unit was then brutally destroyed in the Battle of Brody in West Ukraine in July of 1944, in which about 80% of the men were killed. Then, as the Red Army moved forward, they reconstituted this unit with police men and from all. There was sort of like a vacuum in the area about any sort of man could get. And then they got some much more unsavory elements from the police and whatnot. They were from Eastern Ukraine, Central Ukraine. There were some Russians in there. And these were people that had served in various police formations. So the later they joined this unit, the hired war crimes, because they came then, they transferred from police units. Then as Nazi Germany collapsed, they retreated through Poland into Slovakia, where they partook in the crushing of the so-called Slovak national uprising. There was a national uprising against the puppet Nazi regime of Father Josef Tiso in Slovakia, which was crushed with the help of these Ukrainian liberators. Then they were transferred to Slovenia and to Yugoslavia, and there they fought anti-Nazi resistance fighters, many of them communists. Then retreated up to today's Austria, in the area around Styria or Steiermark, and they fought in a number of battles and capitulated on the 7th and 8th of May to the British. And then the final day, they changed the name from the 14th Waffen-SS to the 1st Ukrainian Division of the Ukrainian National Army. And under that, they have cultivated a memory culture based upon victimization, heroism, sacrifice, brotherhood, and a stalwart fight against communism, right? Then this group sat for 4 years in a camp. They were not formally POWs, because if they had been recognized as POWs, they would have been sent back to Stalin, right? Because they were formally Soviet citizens. But since Western Ukraine, a part of Ukraine, which had been Polish before 1939, since it could claim Polish citizenship, they could be sent back into Poland, stay in the West as so-called surrendered military personnel. And then they came to Canada in 1950 after a very sketchy, incomplete vetting. Nobody asked questions in 1950. This was the Red Scare, of course. What they cared about was not Hitler. The Nazis were gone, or Mussolini, right? They cared about communists. But they could show that they were reliable anti-communists, and Canada needed manpower. These are farm laborers, and very able men, I should say. You know, this was the flower of the Ukrainian intelligentsia. These were people, an elite in a way. 80,000 volunteered, 8,000 got in. These were university students and nationally conscious elements in academia, in law, in this and that, right? So this became, in a way, an elite in Canada, including vice chancellors of the university you and I attended. Mm-hmm.
It's interesting when you're talking about this sort of, you said 80,000 and Galician Ukrainians. So there's a two-parter to that. I think the first part that I'm interested in is, why did they sign up to fight? Is this an anti-communist? Is this anti-Soviet, anti-Stalin?
I think it's all of that. It's all of that. I mean, you have to keep in mind, they had been Polish citizens until Stalin and Hitler jointly carved up Poland, and Stalin shot the Polish elite. So Stalin carried out an utterly brutal occupation. So their experience, from a Galician perspective, for them, the Soviets were occupants. They came. You should keep in mind that Halychyna or Galician had never been part of the Russian Empire, right? It had been Polish from the 1300s up until the partitions of Poland in the 1770s. Then it was Austrian for 125 years. Then it became Polish again in 1918. So these were people to which Russian, very much unlike Kiev or Central Ukraine, they were bilingual. They had never been under Moscow's rule. For them, Polish was the first foreign language, or German, right? Because they were socialized in that tradition. So they were part of Central Europe. 20 years earlier, they'd been Habsburg residents and subjects. Then came Stalin, carried out this utterly brutal occupation. So when the Nazis arrived in Barbarossa, of course, they were greeted in 1941 as liberators, as heroes. And you should keep in mind also that Ukraine did not exist as a polity, as one unit, even during the occupation. So during World War II, Galicia became District Galician, the district of Galicia, which was adjoined to the General Gouvernement, that is Hans Frank's occupied Poland, which in turn was part of Greater Germany. So Lviv, or Lemberg, as it was called at the time in German, was part of Greater Germany. Hmm. The rest of Ukraine constituted the so-called Reichskommissariat, the Reichskommissariat of Ukraine. That included most of Soviet Ukraine. There, the rule was very, very different. So, for example, if you were had your head screwed on right and you were talented as a young Ukrainian in Lviv, there were fellowships and scholarships for you to go as Ukrainian to Prague, to Vienna, to Berlin, and to study. They had general fellowships for Ukrainians. If you cross over into the Reichskommissariat Ukraine, there the brutal Gauleiter and ruler Reichskommissar Erich Koch, and yep. he said that these are untermenschen, they are earmarked for destruction, and they should not get more than 3 years in school, learn the multiplication table up until five. They should know how to read road signs. They won't be playing around on their autobahns. But essentially, this is to treat them like did natives in the American or Canadian West, as a dying breed. 200 years from now, nobody will remember anymore that there were people like Belarusians, Ukrainians, or Lithuanians, that anyone remembers the Sioux and Cree and whatnot in North America, Hitler said in his table talks, right? So there was one set of one rule in Halicina. They formed a Waffen-SS in Halicina, in Galician, right? Not in the Reichskommissariat. Even during the war, they're remembered very, very differently. And there, of course, when the Red Army started pushing back, returning to Central Ukrainians and East Ukrainians lived in the Reichskommissariat, to them, the Soviet rule was horrific. They suffered the famine and all that sort of stuff. Then came the German rule, which was, believe it or not, even harsher, even more brutal than that of Stalinist violence. So many Central Eastern Ukrainians perceived the return of the Red Army as a genuine liberation. Not so in Western Ukraine, to which this was a return of a brutal overlord, right? So even how this is remembered is different, because the Galician Ukrainians in Halychyna, to them, Stalin was the bad guy. Under the Red Army, under the Soviets, however, there was terror and fear. So the memory is also divided. If you, of course, were a Jew, which 35% of the population of Lviv or Lemberg was, they exterminated over 95% of them. So the memories, of course, no Jews were left. The Poles constituted the majority in Lviv. They were deported. So the Polish memories, you have the Ukrainian memories, and you have the Jewish memories. And for the Jewish memories, of course, the Nazis, nothing was worse. The 1 or 2% of the Galician Jews that survived, the return of the Red Army was regarded as a genuine liberation. So the Jewish and Ukrainian memories are very, very different. So to answer your question, they fought against the Red Army. They fought against what they saw as a Muscovite Russian occupation. They fought against communism. They fought against Stalinist terror, which, and all of these things are true. This was a Soviet occupation. It was brutal. It was illegal. It was merciless. And in a sense, I have a certain understanding for why people want to fight back. The problem is, of course, they took oaths directly to Hitler and they fought the return of the Red Army, right?
Right.
And as they did that, as they fought them, fought essentially the Reconquista, liberation, depending on where you come from, as they're fighting in the battle abroad, they're fighting the return of the Red Army, they were exterminating the remnants of the Jews of Europe. So they took an oath directly, not to Germany, because these were not German soldiers. So they were not Nazis, because it couldn't be Nazis, because they were Ukrainians. The Nazi party was a German party, only open for Germans. So they were Nazi collaborators, yeah. If you ask me.
Yeah.
If you ask Ukrainian patriots in diaspora, they would say they cannot be collaborators, because collaborators is something that the French could be. They betrayed the motherland. Well, you know, if you join the Waffen-SS, I think that is a reasonable definition.
And clearly then they are complicit in the Holocaust, are they not?
Well, indirectly, I would say. Indirectly. Okay. I mean, okay. Indirectly at best. I mean, like the Jews of Halicina, Galicia, unlike the Jews of the Reichskommissariat, right? Jews in the bulk of Ukraine, they were killed not by gas, but by bullets. They were shot by the Einsatzgruppen in 1941-42, whereas the Jews in Lviv, some of them were killed in pogroms, there were shootings, but many of them were deported to Berzhet, they camped there, and gassed. So the Jews in Galicia were deported and gassed, whereas in central Ukraine, they were shot, right? So at the time the Waffen-SS Galicia was established in May and April of 1943, the Jews of Lviv were essentially already gone. But they recruited many of the men from units that had been complicit in the Holocaust. The officers in the units, many of them had served in the Einsatzgruppen and in various exterminatory action. The officers and the non-commissioned officers were trained in the vicinity of the Dachau concentration camp. When you join and volunteer to take a personal oath, not to Germany, but to Adolf Hitler personally and serving under Heinrich Himmler, doing that, making a choice, you are, of course, signing up for a regime. Suddenly the Jews are gone.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
They were deported. People knew what happened to them, right? So even after that, they volunteered, took an oath to this regime. They were not directly implicit in that regard, but the Waffen-SS Galicia consisted of three police regiments. This was the elite. Then they had another three police regiments, 4, 5, and 6. And the fourth police regiment was drafted and fought and pacified a Polish village not far away from Lviv, known as Huta Peniatska. The encircled village burned this one down. Up to 1,200 men, women, and children killed, Jews and Poles and whatnot. That was carried out by the 4th Police Regiment. If you fight for Hitler and take up arms to do this, right, you hold them back as the murder continues. If you fight for this genocidal regime, you are co-complicit. You cannot be regarded as a hero.
Yeah, and I think that's really well said, because it, like you've said, it is complicated. It's not as simple as just good guys and bad guys. It's sort of these levels of complicity. I think one of the really complicated stories, which I hope you can illuminate for us, though, is how they end up in Canada.
Well, they ended up in a number of countries. Many of them came to Canada.
Okay.
Some ended up in the United States, but relatively few. Again, here, there is a story that needs to be written, needs to be studied. This list of 7,100 inmates of the Rimini camp, not available. So it's very hard to work on this. I mean, so there's, you know, we can reconstruct parts of this. The Americans, the CIA, kicking and screaming, were forced to release a treasure trove of documents to the 1998 Nazi and Imperial Japanese War Crimes Act, forcing to release enormous amounts of documentation regarding criminals. In 2005 and 2007, Jewish interest groups and lobby groups lobbied for this because there were suspicions that German war criminals came to the United States after the war. And there were some, you know, well, not necessarily war criminals, too many of them, but various Nazi functionaries, Werner von Braun and not. So when they released this treasure trove of documents, it turned out to be relatively few Germans there because the Germans they didn't really trust. But so many Croatians, Balts, and West Ukrainians. And with that documentation, you can reconstruct some of this past. Canada and United Kingdom, and I've said also my country, Sweden, has not been as forthcoming. United States has been very transparent and very open in this regard. So, but we can reconstruct part of this, right? So what happened was in 1949, they were allowed, they were re-emigrating. The Italians could not hold them in his camp. Italy was becoming, of course, sovereign again. Germany was slowly being reconstituted. What to do with his men? They did not want to go back to the Soviet Union, obviously. The British first took them, but shortage of housing, poor living conditions and whatnot. I mean, like they still had like coupons, I believe, to buy pantyhoses and coffee in Britain well up until 1958 to 57, right? So Britain had a tough post-war years and a shortage of housing and whatnot. The British encouraged them to re-emigrate. And the British didn't really screen them. I mean, they estimated needing up to 6 months or 9 months to screen them. They were given a few weeks. So they screened 250, roughly, mostly officers and non-commissioned officers. But the bulk of these roughly 2,000 that came to Canada were not screened. And then they were doled out as farm laborers. These were very skilled labor, in a way, hard working, very, very able people. And he came to Canada. And of course, nobody asked those questions. I mean, the Holocaust was not an issue at this time. This was, as I said, you know, Korean War, Stalin got the bomb and whatnot, right? That's what he cared about. And they were reliable anti-communists, and the Ukrainian-Canadian community were very welcoming. Because to them, this was, for the nationalist part of the Ukrainian community, this was a very welcome boost of a nationally conscious, nationalist, diehard rejuvenation of the community, right? Whereas the communist Ukrainians, which also existed, objected to this. So this also polarized the Ukrainian community. And they did well in Canada. They prospered. This was in many ways an elite. These were people with higher education. And of the 80,000 that volunteered, only 10% got into the unit. The Holocaust was not part of memory culture, right? It was only really with the Eichmann kidnapping, the Eichmann trial, the Auschwitz processes in 63, the Six Days War in Israel, 67. But in particular, the TV miniseries, The Holocaust, that ran on CBC, it ran on NBC, it ran on Zweite Deutsche Fernsehen in Germany and whatnot. In 1978, with that TV series, The Holocaust, it became a household name. It came into the Canadian living rooms and the Swedish living rooms. And there, the Ukrainians and Balts not really figure much other than in by-roles as villain collaborators and as Holocaust perpetrators. Something which stung the Ukrainian diaspora. And at the same time, roughly, the Office of Special Investigation was investigating alleged war criminals. There were a number of high-profile suspects that were denaturalized and deported. Mm-hmm. And when this happened, the Ukrainian diaspora was stung, and they started pushing. They renamed the famine of 1932-33, which was Stalin's greatest crime, claimed the lives of many millions. They started referring that one as to the Holodomor. It starts with hollow, but and often, unfortunately, competitively, as a rule with this number 7 million to trump the hollow with 6 million, or 10 million, as the Ukrainian Congress repeatedly has made his case, saying that more Ukrainians were killed in a famine than Canadians were alive. So this became political battleground. And then, of course, to prevent denaturalization and deportation, they mobilized. And then, of course, came this Deschenes Commission in the 1980s. And the paradox is that the more central the Holocaust became to the memory culture of the Western world, right, which Schindler's List, whatnot, right, in the 1990s, right, in particular. My predecessor here, as a professor of history in our department here in Lund, he likes to joke that the Holocaust became very important in Sweden in 1995. In other words, Sweden joined World War II in 1995. It was very much easier then to decide which good guys, right? Sweden, right, of course, has not a very, very heroic history of 1940, 1941. Yes. But, you know, as we forget. So the Holocaust became very important to Swedes. You know, we must carry on this message, right? Why did it become important in 1995? Well, it did, because of political reasons. Sweden would join the European Union, realigning, you know, doing away with neutrality, and Cold War is gone and whatnot. So this is political issues. So in Canada, the more the Holocaust became central, the more difficult it became to promote this Waffen-SS legacy. So you got here in a microclimate, you got here an internal community which glorified the Waffen-SS Galizien, of course, under the euphemism of the 1st Ukrainian Division of the Ukrainian, right, National Army. So you needed to have this knowledge, you know, what is the 1st Ukrainian Division of the Ukrainian National Army? You need to know Ukrainian, read Cyrillic letters to decodify the memorials that were built in the 70s and 80s in Canada to the, yeah, Waffen-SS various groups. So, of course, within the community, they were very proud of these Waffen-SS veterans. It was a badge of honor to have volunteered for the SS. Not so much in mainstream Canadian society. It was very awkward. And of course, this idea also with the Holocaust, you know, raises questions that the Ukrainian community in Canada were not interested in. They want to talk Holodomor. And the more Holocaust, there was narration of that, the more Holodomor, the higher the numbers went, often in the rhetoric, competitively.
So in the news right now is Hunca. That's the name that everybody seems to be talking about. But what your research has shown is actually, especially the University of Alberta has been actually associated with quite a few of these veterans. And there's a couple of figures that I'm rather interested in. One of them is Volodymyr Kubiyovich. Do you think you could explain who Kubiyovich is to the listeners?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, yes, Hunka, of course, was born in 1925, and he was 18, 19, fresh out of, you know, the equivalent of high school when he joined. He was small fry in that regard. And he donated also money to the Canadian Institute of Ukrainian Studies at the University of Alberta, our joint alma mater. And that one, the university determined was, you know, I don't know exactly how to phrase it. It was causing harm. It's regretful. And they retracted it. I just went through this. There might be more. Another 6 Waffen-SS fellowships. And I found another 7 today. So at least 12 Waffen-SS fellowships. The perhaps most problematic of them all, in my opinion, is also the largest one. That is in the name of Volodymyr Kobyovich, who was the most senior and most prominent Ukrainian collaborator during World War II. He was loosely affiliated with a more moderate, well, sorry, I shouldn't use that term because there's nothing moderate about it. The more conservative wing of the organization of Ukrainian nationalists. They pursued a line of cooperation with German authorities, and he was in charge of what was called the Ukrainian Central Committee in Krakow in Hans Frank's Generalgouvernement already before 1941, so in 40-41 before Barbarossa. And as such, he essentially served the occupants, but he had some minor influence on policy, right? How the dairy business was being carried out and so on. And he was corresponding with German functionaries, including Adolf Eichmann and with Hans Frank, in particular 1940, 1941, very, very aggressively anti-Semitic rhetoric. Committed racist ethnic cleanser. He tried to lobby Hans Frank to say that, you know, since Ukrainians have much more experience of suffering under Jewish exploitation. Now, when the land is being liberated or the Jews being removed, now we have a stronger claim to this Jewish property, this Aryanizing money, right? And he worked with the German authorities. And he was also the one who in 1943 took the initiative to set up a Ukrainian Galician division in Alechina. After the war, he then retreated with the Germans, I believe via Vienna first, and then he ended up in outside of Paris, in Sarcelles, outside of Paris. And there he continued this academic society known as the Shevchenko Academic Society, which was sort of like an emigre academy of sciences for Ukrainians in exile. And then he edited this encyclopedia of Ukraine, first in Ukrainian, and then with Canadian multicultural funding, he did an English translation of this from 1976 to until his death in 1985. So he was a top Ukrainian collaborator. He left behind an endowment of $430,000 Canadian dollars. That is, what, 15 times that of Hunka? Hunka was a 19-year-old at the time. He was the most senior Ukrainian collaborator there was, who was actively lobbying for ethnic cleansing and whatnot, fully committed to this sort of folkish racial nationalism.
Who is Peter Severin, and what is his relationship to all of this going on?
Peter Severin was a lawyer. He was a politician. He was an organizer. He was a university chancellor at the University of Alberta, 1982 to 1986. He was the president, I think they call it, of the World Congress of Free Ukrainians. He was heading this, I said, the provincial Progressive Conservative Party in Alberta. A very able organizer. And he was a Waffen-SS volunteer. He volunteered for the Waffen-SS when he was born in 1927. So he was then, I think he joined in 1944. So he joined late. He was a member of that unit for about a year. We don't know so much about the exact details. Most of the soldiers volunteered. I think my reading of his sort of like between the lines of what he wrote was that he volunteered. His father encouraged him to join. So I don't think he was drafted. The bulk of them were not drafted. Then he fought not in Brody, but he was part of this draft, this enlargement of the unit after Brody, and he appeared to have volunteered. He made it through Slovakia to part of the Battle of Gleichenberg at the border between Austria and Yugoslavia, or what today is Yugoslavia and Austria. Back then, of course, they didn't exist during World War II. Staunch conservative, father of Canadian multiculturalism, very active and very successful in bringing money into Ukrainian causes. As the historian Aya Fujiwara at University of Alberta argued that, you know, Canadian multiculturalism was to a very high degree the result of Ukrainian nationalist lobbying. They were very, very active in this when this buy and buy commission appeared, bilingualism, biculturalism. Ukrainians were the third voice here. And Severin, together with Manoli Lupul, who was the first director of the CIUS, were very, very successful in getting money into their nationalist projects. So he was active in the PLAST Association, the Ukrainian Scouting Association. He was not a scholar. He was an administrator, and I was, by all accounts, I've gone through his memoir here in Ukraine, and I've gone through everything I could find about him. He was an able organizer, and I met him a number of times, and he and his wife made delightful impressions on me. You know, a very sweet couple, and they organized these sort of open lectures at the Plast House in Plast Domivka in Edmonton. I think maybe one should not sentence or just judge a man by that. But he was somebody who volunteered for the Waffen-SS. He was proud of his Waffen-SS past. He inaugurated and built and got the fundraising for the Waffen-SS memorials in Edmonton. He was the keynote speaker in St. Catharines for the 40th anniversary of the Battle of Brody in 1984. He was a proud Waffen-SS veteran and leading the Veterans Association. And he was very much engaged in as a genocide awareness educator, promoting a view of Ukrainians as genocide victims. Not so interested in talking about the Holocaust, I would say. Right. Not so interested in discussing the tattoo under his left arm. But I mean, like every, the rest of us, very complex, and man who performed very well. I mean, I find him a much more, you know, much less problematic figure than somebody like Kubiyovich, who was one of the organizers of this unit. Right. There was this other guy, Levko Babich, who was a member of, he was the Canadian leader of the Waffen-SS veterans. He was not only a member of the Waffen-SS Galitzin, he was also a member of the 5th Waffen-SS division, Viking, fought by Warsaw. I mean, there are some people that are much more problematic. Personally, I like Severin very much, and I think one should account for the complexity. He grew up in a very, very difficult times, but he also did volunteer for the Nazis. Yeah. And the question is, if Humka cannot be saluted, and if he's problematic, if his endowments cannot stand, why should Severin? And between them, these two extremes, you have another 10 fellowships at the University of Alberta. Of course, the situation is that, the humanities are underfunded. Who's going to fund Ukrainian studies? Well, not just the average Joe on the street, you know, but this was a community affair. In a community where volunteering for the Waffen-SS was not only mainstream, it was a badge of honor. The Ukrainian-Canadian Congress regularly saluted them on Remembrance Day. You know, these were heroes to them. So some of this money went into a number of endowments. Some supported Ukrainian scholars that came from Ukraine to study in Canada, which is fine and hunky-dory, very good. The money that went into Kubiyovich's Encyclopedia of Ukraine, which, well, you don't have a camera here, I have it right behind me here. It appeared, you know, the first volume was sponsored, I believe, by the province of Saskatchewan, the other one by Alberta, you know, by multicultural money. Well,
right.
So Kubiyovich not only volunteered and founded the Waffen-SS, then he also edited the encyclopedia. So, of course, he opened that one. There is no entry on the Holocaust, of course. So not only did he, during his very long life, he died in 1985, also whitewash or airbrush the narration of these episodes. And he's honored as a big hero at the University of Alberta, particularly at the Canadian Institute of Ukrainian Studies, when they published their this brochure, this 40 years or 30 years of excellence in 2006 and 2016. Of course, we have a picture of Savarin and Kubiyovich on the front. This is the epitome of success and glory. So there is this history that needs to be addressed and should have been addressed a long time ago. What the Germans call Aufarbeitung, right? Addressing, working through this difficult history, right?
Yeah,
it took the Germans up until the 1960s before they started doing this. The French, I think, did not start addressing the Vichy syndrome up until the death after Mitterrand's death in the 1990s. Right. Right. Germany dealing with the colonial past, with the Hereros in Namibia and whatnot, it was only 5 or 10 years ago. And of course, my own Sweden, you know, they, as my predecessor here, Klaus-Göran Carlson, said, they joined World War II in 1995, and it was easy to join with who the good guys were. So, you know, maybe we should not point fingers here, but as historians, I think it's important to address this issue of Aufarbeitung or processing this history. And in the absence of this, and this is what I was, you know, already when you and I were grad students, well, in 2005, I tried to raise this issue with the Canadian Institute of Ukrainian Studies. No interest whatsoever. And of course, the fear was here when the university glorifies people that were complicit or active in the Holocaust or pledged their allegiance to Adolf Hitler or organized Waffen-SS divisions. Of course, they're opening up to all sorts of accusations, and the unwillingness to deal with this makes things worse. And of course, now I didn't anticipate there would be great war in Europe, and I didn't anticipate that the Canadian Parliament would give a standing, roaring ovation to a Waffen-SS veteran. Yeah. But of course, the optics of this is so disastrous, and it's so you know, to use a normative statement, stupid. So darn unnecessary. This could have been addressed a long time ago. Had they listened to, you know, I was then a young grad student in my late 20s, right? Now I have tenure and I can do what I want, more or less. But then, you know, for me, I was no hero, of course, but, you know, it was not without risk to go and tell that institute, you know, that sit on the money for grad students to say this is not a good idea. And I was stonewalled. And now they have it, what they have. And I could care less about the management or the poor management of that institute, but I do care a lot for Ukraine. And Ukraine is fighting. It's a European democracy fighting for its survival. They've had 6 democratic changes of government. They have a descent of Holocaust survivors president fighting heroically against the neo-imperialist, neo-totalitarian state. And they deserve all the support you can get. And I support Ukraine to 100%. What I'm doing here is like I'm taking Ukrainian scholars here and looking for funding and running this research group here. And my commitment is 100% to Ukraine.
I want to thank you all for listening today. Don't forget, you can find me on Twitter at Doc Boris. That's at DocBoris. You can find us on Facebook. You can find us on Instagram. You can find us on Patreon. And you can find us on all podcast listening devices. And please do not hesitate to write and leave a comment. We love to hear from you. I'm David Boris. Stay curious, friends.